So it's highly focused, very, very high volume, extensive, and very peculiar.
A security firm says that cyber attacks from China should be taken more seriously. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 17th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the State Volcano Observatory receives funds to update systems.
It's obsolete, to say the least. It was obsolete 20 years ago.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message is sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Governor Bill Walker's administration is doubling down on its message that China cannot be conclusively linked to surveillance of Alaska networks earlier this year. Meanwhile, the cybersecurity firm that first reported the activity is cautioning the state to be vigilant against further attacks. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has this story.
When researchers at Recorded Future found evidence of Chinese surveillance of networks in Alaska, they weren't exactly looking for it. Priscilla Marici supervises the team at Recorded Future that put out a report on that surveillance. She says the company's data scientists, intelligence analysts, and engineers were actually trying to figure out what a compromised network in Tibet was being used for.
That kind of led us down sort of this other rabbit hole that takes us through the rest of the report, which is what we see as malicious activity, right, that's coming from this university in China, Tsinghua, which is essentially the equivalent of China's, like, MIT, you could say.
They found evidence that computers at a university in Beijing were being used to gather information on networks in Kenya, Brazil, Mongolia, and Alaska. In Alaska, the report documents over 1 million connections between the Chinese university and several networks in the state, including the Alaska Communications Systems Group, or ACS, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, and the state of Alaska government. There's no evidence that any of those connections successfully penetrated a network in Alaska. No evidence of a hack. When reports of the scanning activity were made public, a spokesperson from Governor Bill Walker's office said it was routine anonymous activity. Basically, someone checking to see if the doors are locked in Alaska's networks.
So it's a bit more than just checking if the front door is locked, right? It's like knocking on all the windows, looking at your security system, poking around in the sand around your house. Also doing it while you're not home and they know you're not going to be home.
Marici says the scanning was very targeted and pointed at a specific number of ports in Alaska networks that are exploitable.
So it's highly focused. Very, very high volume, extensive, and very peculiar, tailored, right, to these Alaskan networks, vulnerabilities that the Chinese actors were looking for.
Walker's administration is also doubling down on the idea that those scans may not have come from China. When reached via text on Friday, Walker's press secretary, Austin Baird, wrote that no one from the state's Office of Information Technology was available to talk about the issue, and that Walker's administration still does not believe that the surveillance came from China. Marici and other cybersecurity experts are questioning the wisdom of ignoring signs that someone in China is attempting to spy on Alaska. She says there's no question that the scanning came from the Chinese university. What isn't clear is whether it came from university students or at the behest of the Chinese government.
People will say that university students, you know, do all kinds of things on university networks. And, you know, how is it possible that you could suspect, right, that this would be a Chinese kind of state-sponsored activity?
Marici points to the timing of the scans between April 6th and June 24th. She says it indicates that Alaska was targeted before and after Walker's trade mission to China in late May. Joseph Lorenzo Hall is the chief technologist at the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Center for Democracy and Technology. He says it's common for this type of scanning to originate from China. It's usually followed up with attacks on the networks.
You know, it seems a little dismissive of the Alaskan government to say, we're not even sure this is from China. If you know, Recorded Future and other folks like that have global infrastructure that can see certain kinds of data flows, they drop in that report the actual IP addresses. You can look for yourself and see that IP address is allocated to Tsinghua University.
Hall says the state should dig deeper and make sure there weren't any successful hacks.
You know, while I can imagine the Alaskan government saying, hey, nothing to see here, whatever, from the PR perspective, I really hope at the same time they're going back and looking at logs and stuff from that time period.
Both Hall and Marici said Alaska should be vigilant against further attempts at surveillance, especially as it continues commercial negotiations with China to build a natural gas pipeline. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Anchorage police have arrested two people in connection with an apartment complex fire last year that killed three people, injured others, and displaced many more. Prosecutors announced today that a grand jury indicted 30-year-old Andrew Eknady and 29-year-old Carly Fox for allegedly starting the February 2017 fire that burned the Royal Suite Lodge. Prosecutors say that prior to the fire, Fox eluded police after crashing her vehicle while intoxicated. Prosecutors say Eknady drove the car to a carport under the apartment complex and started a fire in the car to destroy evidence. Eknady and Fox are charged with counts of second-degree murder, manslaughter, felony assault, and arson, as well as assault on an unborn child, conspiracy, evidence tampering, and failure to control a dangerous fire. A former resident of Anchorage will spend the rest of his life in prison for the Florida airport shooting that left five people dead and six wounded. A judge imposed the sentence Friday upon 28-year-old Esteban Santiago, who pleaded guilty in May to 11 charges in a plea deal. Prosecutors had agreed to not seek the death penalty. Santiago admitted he opened fire with a handgun in a baggage area at Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport in January 2017. An Iraq War veteran, Santiago is diagnosed as schizophrenic but was found competent to understand legal proceedings. Santiago initially told the FBI after the shooting he was under government mind control, then switched to unfounded claims he acted in support of the Islamic State extremist group. The Alaska primary on Tuesday could help determine who sets the agenda for the next legislature. Most of the contested primaries are among Republicans. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with candidates in a primary in Kodiak that could have an impact across Alaska.
When Louise Stutes entered the legislature in 2014, she joined a House majority of mostly fellow Republicans. She says she believes in Republican values and has been a member of the party for 42 years. But she says the caucus didn't make progress on a long-term plan for the state's budget. She says the caucus wasn't willing to compromise.
And the partisanship, it was just unbelievable. And what did we get done? Zero. We got nothing done.
Stutes says that's why she joined a new majority with two other Republicans, two independents, and 17 Democrats. She notes that the legislature then passed a bill to draw money from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings that closed most of the gap between what the state spends and what it brings in. Stutes' caucus switch and her votes draw criticism from her primary challenger, Rich Walker.
You know, that was pretty bad as far as I look at it, and so do a lot of other people. If you look at her record, there's a lot of things that she voted for that I totally don't agree with, which is cutting the permanent fund and taxes.
Walker hopes he's part of a broader change in the legislature.
I think we need a fresh new start down there, and hopefully we'll get a bunch of us down there this year to come into Juneau and work together.
Walker supports restoring permanent fund dividends to the full amount under the formula used before cuts in the last three budgets. He says that any gap in funding state government shouldn't come out of the pockets of middle and lower income Alaskans. Stutes says the full dividends would force the state to either draw down savings that would eliminate PFDs in the long run or require deep cuts to government services.
What that tells me is goodbye Alaska Marine Highway System, goodbye airport maintenance, which means fewer flights in and out, goodbye snow removal in the winter, goodbye public safety.
The sources for campaign contributions for the two candidates reflects a broader trend in the state. Rich Walker's received support from the Alaska Republican Party. Labor unions are among Stutes' campaign donors. Another Republican who switched caucuses, Anchorage Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, also is facing a challenger, Aaron Weaver. The third House member who was a Republican who switched caucuses is Paul Seaton of Homer. He's running as a registered nonpartisan in the Democratic primary. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the difficulties of being a village public safety officer.
We're known as the suicide capital of the United States. After the last one, I just decided I had enough.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The village of Napakiak received federal funding this week that could help them respond to the imminent threat of climate change. Napakiak's shoreline is eroding at an alarming rate, even by Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta standards. The small village has lost 50 feet of its shoreline since May. Tribal Administrator David Andrew says the river swept most of that tundra away in a single storm.
Some of us actually went down, and at the time we walked down there and went to check it out.
Napakiak's boat and hovercraft landing was destroyed. Residents rely on it for food and supply deliveries. Andrew says the village has been getting its food flown into town ever since, which is a lot more expensive. Erosion also threatens the community's school and fuel depot. So Napakiak turned to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for help. Yesterday, the agency gave Napakiak an imminent threat grant for $449,000. The money will help the community design and build a new landing for hovercraft, barges, and residents' boats. Andrew says the community's grateful for the funding. He says the village will need to move.
When I was a little boy, Napakiak used to be way down there, and there was a school, and it was torn down because of erosion, and they built another one over here, and now it's in danger from erosion. Our community moves any infrastructure that is in danger from the erosion. We just keep moving them back.
Many of these moves have happened quietly without much publicity or federal or state funding, Andrew says. Napakiak held a fiddle dance recently to raise enough money to move a house which was dangerously close to the river's banks. There's a huge network of instruments set up on mountains across Alaska. They're supposed to detect rumblings and explosions from dozens of volcanoes around the state. The idea is to make sure planes don't fly through clouds of volcanic ash. And as Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, the system is getting an upgrade.
Trust me, you really, really don't want your plane to fly through a cloud of volcanic ash. It happened once in the 80s in Alaska. A 747 was on its way to Japan when it flew into an ash cloud that had drifted more than 100 miles from Mount Redoubt. Here's a crew member talking with air traffic control as all four of the plane's engines cut out. The plane was carrying 250 people. It lost half its elevation before pilots could restart the engines and land in Anchorage. The city has one of the nation's busiest cargo airports. Today, pilots depend on the Alaska Volcano Observatory, which is a partnership between the state and federal governments and University of Alaska Fairbanks. The observatory buries instruments called seismometers on the sides of volcanoes. They measure rumblings and explosions and send data by radio. Scientists then use the data to help issue forecasts and warnings. Except the system still depends on old-school equipment. Tom Murray oversees the Volcano Observatory for the U.S. Geological Survey.
It was designed when it was copper phone connections in between the houses, and there was no such thing as the digital world that we live in. So it's obsolete, to say the least. It was obsolete 20 years ago. And it's more obsolete now.
Murray says that presents all kinds of limitations. The old equipment transmits noise, like the static you hear if you have fuzzy reception. It's bad at picking up more than one type of vibration, which makes it hard to detect both tiny movements and big explosions. Now the system is getting an overhaul. Earlier this year, Congress budgeted $12 million for upgrades. Over the next few years, the obsolete equipment is going to be replaced by a modern digital system. Murray describes it with an orchestra analogy.
Our current system, you might say, is really good for the viola section. Violins, a little, but that gets kind of high and you can't hear that very well. And then the bass you forget about completely.
He says the new system will capture all the instruments at different volumes.
So not only do you get the entire orchestra, but you can hear it when it's just playing a little tiny, little very quiet piece, but also when it's going full blast.
Switching to digital transmission will help scientists block out noise from their seismic readings and give them more confidence in their forecasts. With the old system, uncertainty about the data could force the observatory to issue more cautious warnings. Planes would have to avoid a larger area or avoid it for longer. Murray says the new digital transmission equipment will also make it easier to pair the observatory's seismic equipment with webcams and other instruments. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Starting next year, Unalaska retailers won't be allowed to distribute single-use plastic bags to their customers. And if they do, they'll be hit with a $100 fine each time. The city council passed the bag ban unanimously this week after about 6 months of discussion and overwhelming public support. Councilor James Fitch says it'll help reduce the amount of plastic littering local beaches and polluting the ocean.
Currently, there's a flotilla of plastic the size of Texas in the Pacific Ocean. It's getting in our food source, it's killing animals, so I think this is a good start, and I think we need to make it go farther.
With an economy dependent on healthy fisheries, several Unalaskans have called on the council to ban other pervasive plastics, like disposable straws and industrial pallet wrap. Before they consider widening the ban, councilors are still deciding how retailers should handle their existing bag inventories. Vice Mayor Dennis Robinson has suggested the city buy out leftover stock, both to help business managers and to ensure bags are secured in the landfill instead of blowing around. The city manager is researching how much that would cost. Councilor Sherry Coleman's proposal to delay the ban and let inventory run out failed to garner enough support. Unalaska's plastic bag ban goes into effect January 1st. The island will join more than a dozen Alaska communities that have prohibited their distribution.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, small town safety. Like many communities in Alaska, the village of Cake has an on-again, off-again history of local law enforcement. A year after the tragic death of a teenage girl, a case that still hasn't been solved, the lights in the village public safety office are now back on. KFSK's Alana Elder has the story.
Driving around Cake is something Joel Jackson spends most weekend evenings doing. He's the Cake Tribal Council president. He's also sort of an unofficial guardian for this town of 600. When he was younger, Jackson was the village police officer. But over the decades, the town has often gone without any.
They come and go. And when we didn't have any police officers, I answered calls because nobody else was doing it.
He volunteers with emergency medical services, so he's one of the first people to know when someone needs help in Cake, like last August.
I got a text message saying there's a young lady that was unresponsive.
The young lady was Jackson's cousin's daughter, Jade Williams, who had turned 19 just 3 days earlier. Her father was away working on a fishing boat, and her grandmother was also out of town. There was a party at their house. By 9:30 that evening, the neighbors were calling Alaska State Troopers because Williams wasn't breathing.
By the time I got there, they had already started CPR on her and then brought her up to the health center here,
where Williams was pronounced dead. A year later, the case still hasn't been solved. State troopers won't comment on an open investigation, but the incident report classified Williams' death as suspicious. Jackson says there was alcohol involved, and neighbors later told him it had sounded like people at the party were fighting.
When I talked to the troopers, I come in here, he said it was a homicide. Somebody killed her, or blunt force trauma.
A wildlife trooper responded by boat from Petersburg, 65 miles away. Blue Shirt troopers, the state police trained to investigate people crimes, arrived the next afternoon from Juneau, traveling more than 100 miles.
It was a little bit faster than the last one, probably about 12 hours. And same thing, we posted people around the house, so nobody could get in there.
When he says the last one, he's talking about Mackenzie Howard, a 13-year-old who was murdered in Cake 5 years ago. Her family has planned a memorial for her in August. Howard's and Williams's cases exist alongside thousands of Native American and Alaska Native women who've been murdered or gone missing. It's widely known that many of these cases go uncounted. Howard's case was solved, and a local teenager was charged for her murder.
Pretty tough time for us. Still is. We kind of walk around on pins and needles, you know.
Small town relationships are one challenge to having law enforcement across Alaska. It can be an intense, lonely job. Jackson was police officer during an especially difficult time and quit after only about 2 years.
The last year and a half I was chief police, we had 15 suicides. We're known as the suicide capital of the United States. After the last one, I just decided I had enough.
Jackson was the first on the scene every time something terrible happened in a town where he knew everyone. The suicide crisis in Cake ended, thanks in part to a group of community leaders who started brainstorming solutions.
Culture Camp for the Kids was one of the first ones. We just had our 30th anniversary of the Culture Camp, so that's a testament to trying to get the young people back into the culture, back into our way of life.
All this to say, Cake has pulled through hard times before. The day after Jackson and I meet is the day of Cake's annual Dog Salmon Festival. Multiple people remark that it's nice to see friends and family all in one place having fun and not at a funeral. One of the town's new village public safety officers, Dean Kavanaugh, is there, sitting in civilian clothes above the dunk tank. There's a line of mostly teenagers who paid $5 to try and knock him in. Kavanaugh grew up in Cake, spent the last few years in Anchorage, and moved back in 2017.
I got a family now. I got two boys, a fiance.
He needed a job, and he says a couple of local leaders suggested he take the open VPSO position. It meant something that they thought he could do it. Kavanaugh's partner, Ruel Hines, says their duties actually go beyond law enforcement.
We're pretty much the public servant for the area, so however we could help, we kind of lend a hand.
Officially, they function as EMTs, search and rescue, firefighters, and police. Until mid-November, Kavanaugh and Hines will be away from Cake, attending a four-month training. As nonprofits grapple with how to fill vacant VPSO positions across Alaska, Cake residents will be waiting for theirs to return. Also waiting is Jade Williams' family. Her father and grandmother have left town to heal and wait for answers on the death. For AK, I'm Alana Elder.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Cece Esparza in Kodiak. Esparza has been a social worker all over the state and is the longest volunteer host at KMXT in Kodiak. She's originally from California.
I left home when I was 17. At that time, I had a boyfriend who had a sister who was a mother superior in Mexico City. And so I was going to go to Mexico City and be the secretary for the convent. And so I was all set to do that. And then the bishop in Mexico decided that because I was like 19 or 20, whatever I was, and at the time that we were talking about it, that I had to live in the convent. And I said, no way, Jose, I have not been home. You know, I've not been under anyone's thumb since I was 17. You know, it was very, very restrictive. And I said, I can't live like that. I had just decided then I was going to apply to Berkeley because I had not gone to school other than high school. And I made an application to Berkeley when this opportunity to come to Alaska happened. So I came to Alaska. Today is my 50th anniversary of coming to Alaska. I came to Alaska June 1st, 1968. I had a one-way ticket, I had $90 to my name, I had a suitcase of clothes, and I had a temporary place to stay. In Anchorage. In those days, many of the side streets, the fronts in town, were not paved. That was long before the Parks Highway opened, and there was just two lanes. And that was before they cut all the trees down by Ammendorf, because I can remember crying when I went down the road because they had chopped all the trees down to make four lanes at that time. Now it's, six or eight lanes? But yeah. It's a long, long time ago and far, far away.
Cece Esparza lives in Kodiak. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Alana Elder, Daisha Eaton, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. Also, season 2 of the podcast Midnight Oil from Alaska's Energy Desk is out now. That, just like Alaska News Nightly, is available wherever you get your podcasts. Tonight, we had reports from Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel, Nat Herz in Anchorage, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is David Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at meetings on Wednesday, August 22nd and Thursday, August 23rd, starting at 9 a.m. at the Inupiat Heritage Center in Utqiagvik. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.